Side 21. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 748.
Ah, it's the bunk, replies Eddie Pensiero. You don't hear no discharge, you big dumb-headed Mick. Hey, Pensiero, you know what an Italian submarine sounds like on that new sonar, huh? What? Ping, guinea, 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 whap, whap, whap. That's what. Yuck, yuck, yuck.
Fuck yous, says Eddie, and commences combing the colonel's silver-black hair. The moment the comb contacts his head, the colonel begins to speak. Ordinarily, we'd spend no more than 24 hours on a house-to-house sweep, sundown to sundown, house-to-house. There's a quality of black and gold to either end of it, that way, silhouettes, shaken skies, pure as a cyclorama. But these sunsets out here, I don't know. Do you suppose something has exploded somewhere? Really, somewhere in the east? Another Krakatoa? Another name, at least that exotic. The colors are so different now. Volcanic ash, or any finely divided substance suspended in the atmosphere, can diffract the colors strangely. Did you know that, son? Hard to believe, isn't it? Rather a long taper, if you don't mind, and just short of combable on top. Yes, Private, the colors change, and how? The question is, are they changing according to something? Is the sun's everyday spectrum being modulated? Not at random, but systematically by this unknown debris in the prevailing winds, is there information for us? Deep questions and disturbing ones.
Where you from, son? I'm from Kenosha, Wisconsin. My folks have a little farm back there, snow fields and fence posts all the way to Chicago. The snow covers the old cars up on blocks in the yards, big white bundles. It looks like Graves registration back there in Wisconsin.
Hey, Pensiero,
calls Patty McGonagall. You still hearing that sound?
Yeah, I think it's a mouth organ.
Pensiero busily combing up single hairs, cutting each one a slightly different length, going back again and again to touch up here and there. God is who knows their number. Atropos is who severs them to different lengths. So, God under the aspect of Atropos, she who cannot be turned, is in possession of Eddie Pensiero tonight.
I got your mouth organ, jeers Patty. Right here, look, a wop clarinet.
Each long haircut is a passage. Hair is yet another kind of modulated frequency. Assume a state of grace in which all hairs were once distributed perfectly even, a time of innocence when they fell perfectly straight all over the colonel's head. Winds of the day, gestures of distraction, sweat, itchings, sudden surprises, 3-foot falls to the edge of sleep, watched skies, remembered shames, all have since written on that perfect grating. Passing through it tonight, restructuring it, Eddie Pensiero is an agent of history. Along with the reworking of the colonel's head runs the shiver-born blues. Long runs in number 2 and 3 hole correspond, tonight anyway, to passages in the deep reaches of hair, birch trunks in a very humid state, approaches to a stone-wooded park, stags beside the high flags. Is a matter of lower sideband. You suck a clear note on pitch and then bend it lower with the muscles of your face. Muscles of your face have been laughing, tight with pain, often not to betray any emotion. Where you send the pure note is partly a function of that. There's that secular basis for blues, if the spiritual angle bothers you.
Oh, where I was, relates the colonel, I kept climbing down these big sheared chunks of concrete, black reinforcing rod poking out, black rust. There were touches of royal purple in the air, not to blur out over their edges or change the substance of the night. They dribbled down, lengthening out, one by one. Ever seen a chicken fetus just beginning? Oh, of course not. You're a city boy. There's a lot to learn out of the farm. Teaches you what a chicken fetus is, so that if you happen to be climbing down a concrete mountain in the dark and see one or several up in the sky reproduced in purple, you'll know what they look like. That's a heap better than the city, son. There you just move from crisis to crisis. Each one brand new. Nothing to couple it back onto.
Well, there he is, cautiously edging along the enormous ruin, his hair at the moment looking very odd, forward and up in great long points, forming a black sunflower or sunbonnet around his face, in which the prominent feature is the colonel's long, crawling, magenta lips. Things grab up for him out of crevices among the debris. Sort of fast, happy lunge out and back in. Thin pincer arms. Nothing personal. Just thought I'd grab a little night air. Ha ha. When they miss the colonel, as they always seem to do, why, they just zip back in with a gambler's ho-hum. Well, maybe next time. Damn it, Cut off from my regiment here, going to be captured and cremated by dacoits. Jesus, there they are now, unthinkable animals running low in the light from the G5 version of the city. Red and yellow turbans, scarred, dope-fiend faces, fared as the front end of a 37 Ford. Same undirected eyes, same exemption from the karmic hammer. The 37 Ford exempt from the KH? Come on, quit fooling. They'll all end up in junkyards, same as the rest. Oh, will they, Skippy? Why are there so many on the roads, then? Mr. Information, the war, I mean, there's no new cars being built right now, so we all have to keep our old reliable in tip-top shape, because there's not too many mechanics left here on the home front, eh? And we shouldn't hoard gas, and we should keep that A sticker prominently displayed in the lower right. Skippy, you little fool, you are off on another of your senseless and retrograde journeys. Come back here to the points. Here is where the paths divided. See the man back there. He is wearing a white hood. His shoes are brown. He has a nice smile, but nobody sees it. Nobody sees it because his face is always in the dark. But he is a nice man. He is the pointsman. He is called that because he throws the lever that changes the points. And we go to Happyville instead of to Payne City or Der Leidstadt. That's what the Germans call it. There is a mean poem about the Leidsch German man named Mr. Rilke. But we will not read it because we are going to Happyville. The pointsman has made sure we'll go there. He hardly has to work at all. The lever is very smooth and easy to push. Even you could push it, Skippy, if you knew where it was. But look what a lot of work he has done with just one little push. He has sent us all the way to Happyville instead of to Payne City. That is because he knows just where the points and the lever are. He is the only kind of man who puts in very little work and makes big things happen all over the world. He could have sent you on the right trip back there, Skippy. You can have your fantasy if you want. You probably don't deserve anything better, but Mr. Information tonight is in a kind mood. He will show you Happyville. He will begin by reminding you of the 1937 Ford. Why is that dacoit-faced auto still on the roads? The war, just as you rattled over the points onto the wrong track. The war was the set of points, eh? Yes, yes, Skippy. The truth is that the war is keeping things alive. Things. The Ford is only one of them. The Germans and Japs story was only one, rather surrealistic version of the real war. The real war is always there. The dying tapers off now and then, but the war is still killing lots and lots of people, only right now it is killing them in more subtle ways. Often in ways that are too complicated, even for us at this level, to trace. But the right people are dying, just as they do when armies fight. The ones who stand up, in basic, in the middle of the machine gun pattern. The ones who do not have faith in their sergeants. The ones who slip and show a moment's weakness to the enemy. These are the ones the war cannot use, and so they die. The right ones survive. The others, it's said, even know they have a short life expectancy, but they persist in acting the way they do. Nobody knows why. Wouldn't it be nice if we could eliminate them completely? Then no one would have to be killed in the war. That would be fun, wouldn't it, Skippy? Jeepers, it sure would, Mr. Information. Wow, I can't wait to see Happyville. Happily, he doesn't have to wait at all. Dacoits comes leaping, whistling sound, ecru silk cord strung, buzzing tight between his fists. Eager, let's get to it, grin, and just at the same moment, a pair of arms comes up out of a fissure in the ruins and gathers the colonel down to safety just in time. The dacoit falls on his ass and sits there trying to pull the cord apart, muttering, oh shit, which even dacoits do, too. You are under the mountain, a voice announces. Stony cave acoustics in here. Please remember from this point on to obey all pertinent regulations. His guide is a kind of squat robot, dark gray plastic with rolling headlamp eyes, shaped something like a crab. That's cancer in Latin, says the robot, and in Kenosha too. It will prove to be addicted to one-liners that never quite come off for anyone but it. Here is Muffin Tin Road, announces the robot. Note the smiling faces on all the houses here. Upstairs windows are eyes, picket fences teeth, nose is the front door. Say, asks the colonel, taken by a sudden thought, does it ever snow, Happyville? Does what ever snow? You're evading. I'm evading room Vino from Wisconsin, things this boorish machine. And you ought to see the nurses run. So what else is new, Jackson? The squat creature is actually chewing gum. A Laszlo Jampf variation on polyvinyl chloride, very malleable, even sending out detachable molecules which, through an ingenious osmoelectrische Schalterwerke developed by Siemens, is transmitting in code a damn fair approximation of Beeman's licorice flavor to the robot crab's brain. Mr. Information always answers questions. For what he's making, I'd even question answers. Does it ever snow? Of course it snows in Happyville. A lot of snowmen would sure be sore if it didn't. I recall back in Wisconsin, the wind used to blow right up the walk, like a visitor who expects to be let in. Sweeps the snow up against the front door, leaves it drifted there. Ever get that in Happyville? Old stuff, says the robot. Anybody ever open his front door while the wind was doing that, eh? Thousands of times. Then, pounces the colonel, if the door is the house's nose and the door is open, eh, and all of those snowy white crystals are blowing up from Muffin Tin Road in a big cloud right into the... Ah! Screams the plastic robot and scuttles away into a narrow alley. The colonel finds himself alone in a brown and wine-aged district of the city. Sandstone and adobe colors sweep away in a progress of walls, rooftops, streets. Not a tree in sight. And who's this comes strolling down the Schokoladestrasse? Why, it's Laszlo Jampf himself, grown to a prolonged old age, preserved like a 37 Ford against the world's ups and downs, which are never more than damped out changes in smile, wide pearly to wistfully gauze inside Happyville here. Dr. Jampf is wearing a bow tie of a certain limp grayish lavender, a color for long dying afternoons through conservatory windows, minor keyed leader about days gone by, plaintive pianos, pipe smoke in a stuffy parlor, overcast Sunday walks by canals. Here the two men are dry-scratched precisely, attentively on this afternoon, and the bells across the canal are tolling the hour. The men have come from very far away, after a journey neither quite remembers, on a mission of some kind, but each has been kept ignorant of the other's role. Now it turns out that this light bulb over the current here is the same identical Osram light bulb that Franz Perkler used to keep next to in his bunk at the underground rocket works at Nordhausen. Statistically, so their story goes, every N-thousandth light bulb is going to be perfect. All the delta Qs piling up just right, so we shouldn't be surprised that this one's still around, burning brightly. But the truth is even more stupendous. This bulb is immortal. It's been around, in fact, since the 20s, has that old-timery point at the tip and is less pear-shaped than more contemporary bulbs. What a history, this bulb, if only it could speak. Well, as a matter of fact, it can speak. It is dictating the muscular modulations of Paddy McGonagall's cranking tonight. This is a loop here with feedback through Paddy to the generator again. Here it is, the story of Byron the Bulb. Byron was to have been manufactured by Tungsram in Budapest. He would probably have been grabbed up by the ace salesman, Geza Rosa Volgi's father, Sandor, who covered all the Transylvanian territory and had begun to go native enough to where the Home Office felt vaguely paranoid about him throwing some horrible spell on the whole operation if they didn't give him what he wanted. Actually, he was a salesman who wanted his son to be a doctor, and that came true. But it may have been the bad, witch-leery auras around Budapest that got the birth of Byron reassigned at the last minute to Osram in Berlin. Reassigned, yes. There is a bulb baby heaven. Amiably satirized as if it was the movies or something. Well, big business, ha-ha. But don't let them fool you. This is a bureaucracy first, and a bulb baby heaven only as a sort of sideline. All overhead, yes, out of its own pocket, the company is springing for square leagues of organdy, hogsheads of IG Farben pink and blue baby dye, hundredweights of clever Siemens electric baby bulb pacifiers, giving the suckling bulb the shape of a 110-volt current without the least trickle of power. One way or another, these bulb folks are in the business of providing the appearance of power, power against the night, without the reality. Actually, BBH is rather shabby. The brown rafters drip cobwebs. Now and then a roach shows up on the floor, and all the babies try to roll over to look. Being bulbs, they seem perfectly symmetrical, Skippy, but don't forget the contact at the top of the thread, going, ugh, ugh. glowing feebly at the bewildered roach sitting paralyzed and squashable out on the bare boards, rushing, reliving the terror of some sudden blast of current out of nowhere and high overhead the lambent all-seeing bulb. In their innocence, the baby bulbs don't know what to make of this roach's abreaction. They feel his fright, but don't know what it is. They just want to be his friend. He's interesting and has good moves. Everybody's excited except for Byron, who considers the other bulb babies a bunch of saps. It is a constant struggle to turn their thoughts on anything meaningful. Hi there, babies, I'm Byron the Bulb, here to sing a little song to you that goes, "Light up and shine, you incandescent bulb babies. Looks like you got rabies. Just lay there foaming and a-screaming like a bunch of little demons. I'm delivering unto you a kingdom of roaches, and nothing approaches that joyful feeling when you're up on the ceiling looking down night and day on the kingdom you survey. They'll come out and love you till the break of dawn, but they run like hell when that light comes on. So shine on, baby bulbs, you're the wave of the future, and I'm here to recruit you in my great crusade. Just sing along, babies, come on and join the big parade." Trouble with Byron's, he's an old, old soul trapped inside the glass prison of a baby bulb. He hates this place. Lying on his back, waiting to get manufactured. Nothing to listen to on the speakers but Charleston music. Now and then an address to the nation. What kind of a setup's that? Byron wants to get out of here and into it. Needless to say, he's been developing all kinds of nervous ailments. Baby bulb diaper rash, which is a sort of corrosion on his screw threads. Bulb baby colic, a tight spasm of high resistance someplace among the deep loops of tungsten wire. Bulb baby hyperventilation, where it actually feels like his vacuum's been broken, though there is no organic basis. When M-Day finally does roll around, you can bet Byron's elated. He has passed the time hatching some really insane, grandiose plans. He's going to organize all the bulbs, see, get him a power base in Berlin. He's already hep to the strobing tactic. All you do is develop the knack, yogic almost, of shutting off and on at a rate close to the human brain's alpha rhythm, and you can actually trigger an epileptic fit. True. Byron has had a vision against the rafters of his ward of 20 million bulbs all over Europe at a given synchronizing pulse arranged by one of his many agents in the grid, all these bulbs beginning to strobe together. Humans thrashing around the 20 million rooms like fish on the beaches of perfect energy. Attention, humans. This has been a warning to you. Next time a few of us will explode. Ha ha. Yes, we'll unleash our kamikaze squad of the Kyrgyz light. Well, that's the ass end of a firefly compared to what we're gonna... Oh, you haven't heard of the... Oh, well, too bad. Because a few bulbs, say a million, a mere 5% of our number, are more than willing to flame out in one grand burst instead of patiently waiting out their design hours. So Byron dreams of his guerrilla strike force. Gonna get Herbert Hoover, Stanley Baldwin, all of them, right in the face with one coordinated blast. Is Byron in for a rude awakening? There is already an organization, a human one, known as Phoebus, the International Light Bulb Cartel, headquartered in Switzerland. Run pretty much by International GE, Osram, and Associated Electrical Industries of Britain, which are in turn owned 100%, 29%, and 46% respectively by the General Electric Company in America. Phoebus fixes the prices and determines the operational lives of all the bulbs in the world, from Brazil to Japan to Holland, although Philips in Holland is the mad dog of the cartel, apt at any time to cut loose and sow disaster throughout the great combination. Given this state of general repression, there seems no place for a newborn baby bulb to start but at the bottom. But Phoebus doesn't know yet that Byron is immortal. He starts out his career at an all-girl opium den in Charlottenburg, almost within sight of the statue of Werner Siemens, burning up in a sconce, one among many bulbs witnessing the more languorous forms of Republican decadence. He gets to know all the bulbs in the place. Benito the Bulb, over in the next sconce, who's always planning an escape. Bernie, down the hall in the toilet, who has all kinds of Eurolagnia jokes to tell. is Mother Brenda in the kitchen who talks of hashish hush puppies. Dildos rigged to pump floods of paregoric orgasm to the capillaries of the womb. Prayers to Astarte and Lilith, queen of the night, reaches into the true night of the other, cold and naked on linoleum floors after days without sleep. The dreams and tears become a natural state. One by one, over the months, the other bulbs burn out and are gone. The first few of these hit Byron hard. He's still a new arrival, still hasn't accepted his immortality, but on through the burning hours he starts to learn about the transience of others, learns that loving them while they're here becomes easier and also more intense, to love as if each design hour will be the last. Byron soon enough becomes a permanent old-timer. Others can recognize his light, but it's never discussed, except in a general way when folklore comes flickering in from other parts of the grid. Tales of the Kabbalists' study in Lyon, who's supposed to know magic, another in Norway, outside a warehouse facing Arctic whiteness with a stoicism more subtly bulbs begin strobing faintly just at the thought of. If other immortals are out there, they remain silent. But it is a silence with much, perhaps everything, in it. After love, then, Byron's next lesson is silence. As his burning lengthens towards 600 hours, the monitors in Switzerland begin to keep more of an eye on Byron. The Phoebus surveillance room is located under a little-known alp, a chilly room crammed full of German electro-hardware, glass, brass, ebonite, and silver, massive terminal blocks shaggy with copper clips and screws, and a cadre of super-clean, white-robed watchers who wander meter to meter, light as snow devils, making sure that nothing's going wrong, that through no bulb shall the mean operating life be extended. You can imagine what it would do to the market if that started happening. Byron passes surveillance's red line at 600 hours, and immediately, as a matter of routine, he is checked out for filament resistance, burning temperature, vacuum, power consumption. Everything's normal. Now Byron is to be checked out every 50 hours hereafter. A soft chime will go off in the monitoring station whenever it's time. At 800 hours, another routine precaution, a Berlin agent is sent out to the opium den to train asbestos-lined kid gloves and 7-inch spike heels. No, not so she can fit in with the crowd, but so that she can reach that sconce to unscrew Byron. The other bulbs watch in barely subdued terror. The word goes out along the grid. At something close to the speed of light, every bulb, azos looking down the empty black Bakelite streets, Nitralampen and Wotan G's at night soccer matches, Just Wolframs, Monowatts, and Sirius's, every bulb in Europe knows what's happened. They are silent with impotence, with surrender in the face of struggles they thought were all myth. We can't help, this common thought humming through pastures of sleeping sheep, down autobahns and to the bitter ends of coaling piers in the north. There's never been anything we could do. Anyone shows us the meanest hope of transcending, and the Committee on Incandescent Anomalies comes in and takes him away. Some do protest, maybe, here and there, but it's only information. Glow-modulated, harmless, nothing close to the explosions in the faces of the powerful that Byron once envisioned, back there in his baby ward, in his innocence. He is taken to Neukölln, to a basement room, the home of a glassblower who is afraid of the night and who will keep Byron glowing and on watch over all the flint bowls, the griffins and flowerships, ibixes in mid-leap, green spiderwebs, somber ice deities. This is one of many so-called control points where suspicious bulbs can be monitored easily. In less than a fortnight, a gong sounds along the ice and stone corridors of the Phoebus headquarters, and faces swivel over briefly from their meters. Not too many gongs around here. Gongs are special. Byron has passed 1,000. Procedure now is standard. The Committee on Incandescent Anomalies sends a hitman to Berlin. But here, something odd happens. Yes, damned odd. The plan is to smash up Byron and send him back right there in the shop to Cullet and Batch, salvage the tungsten, of course, and let him be reincarnated in the glassblower's next project, a balloon setting out on a journey from the top of a white skyscraper. This wouldn't be too bad a deal for Byron. He knows as well as Phoebus does how many hours he has on him. Here in the shop, he's watched enough glass being melted back into the structureless pool from which all glass forms spring and respring, and wouldn't mind going through it himself. But he is trapped on the karmic wheel. The glowing orange batch is a taunt, a cruelty. There's no escape for Byron. He's doomed to an infinite regress of sockets and bulb snatchers. In zips young Hansel Geschwindig of Weimar Street Urchin, twirls Byron out of the ceiling into a careful pocket, and Geschwindig out the door again. Darkness invades the dreams of the glassblower. Of all the unpleasantries, his dreams grab in out of the night air, and extinguished light is the worst. Light in his dreams was always hope, the basic mortal hope. As the contacts break helically away, hope turns to darkness, and the glassblower wakes sharply tonight, crying, "Who? Who?" Phoebus isn't exactly thrown into a frenzy. It's happened before. There is still a procedure to follow. It means more overtime for some employees, so there's that vague, full-boweled pleasure at the windfall, equally vague excitement at the break in routine. You want high emotion. Forget Phoebus. Their stone-faced search parties move out into the streets. They know more or less where in the city to look. They are assuming that no one among their consumers knows of Byron's immortality. So the data for non-immortal bulb snatchings ought to apply also to Byron. And the data happen to hump up in poor sections, Jewish sections, drug, homosexual, prostitute, and magic sections of the capital. Here are the most logical bulb snatchers in terms of what the crime is. Look at all the propaganda. It's a moral crime. Phoebus discovered, one of the great undiscovered discoveries of our time, that consumers need to feel a sense of sin. That guilt in proper invisible hands is a most powerful weapon. Lyle Bland and his psychologists had figures. Expert testimony and money, money in the Puritan sense, an outward and visible okay on their intentions, enough to tip the discovery of guilt at the cusp between scientific theory and fact. Growth rates in later years were to bear Bland out. Actually, what bore Bland out was an honorary pallbearer sextet of all the senior members of Salutieri, Poor, Nash, De Brutus, and Short, plus Lyle Jr., who was sneezing. Buddy, at the last minute, decided to go see Dracula. He was better off. Of all the legacies Bland left around, the bulb-snatching heresy was perhaps his grandest. It doesn't just mean that somebody isn't buying a bulb. It also means that same somebody is not putting any power in that socket. It is a sin both against Phoebus and against the grid. Neither one is about to let that get out of hand. So out go the Phoebus Flatfoots, looking for the snatched Byron. But the urchin has already left town, gone to hum to a Repaban prostitute so he can shoot up some morphine. The young woman's customer tonight is a cost accountant who likes to have light bulbs screwed into his asshole. And this John has also brought a little hashish to smoke, so by the time he leaves, he's forgotten about Byron still there in his ass. Doesn't ever, in fact, find out, because when he finally gets around, having stood up in trolleys all the way home, it's on his own home toilet, and plop, there goes Byron in the water, and flush, away down the waistlines to the Elbe estuary. He is just round enough to get through smoothly all the way. For days he floats over the North Sea till he reaches Helgoland, that red and white Napoleon pastry tipped in the sea. He stays there for a while at a hotel between the Hengst and the till, being brought back one day to the mainland by a very old priest who's been put hep to Byron's immortality in the course of a routine dream about the taste of a certain 1911 Hochheimer. Suddenly here's the great Berlin Eispalast, booming, dim iron, the smell of women in leathers, fur skating costumes, ice dust in the air, flashing legs, jutting haunches, desire in grip-like flashes, helplessness at the end of a crack the whip, rocketing through beams of sunlight choked with the powdered ice, and a voice in the blurred mirror underfoot saying, "Find the one who has formed this miracle. He is a saint. Expose him. Expedite his canonization." The name is on a list the old man presently draws up of about 1,000 tourists who have Helgoland since Byron was found on the beach. The search by train, footpath, and Hispano Suiza, checking out each of the tourists on his list. But he gets no farther than Nuremberg, where his valise, with Byron wrapped inside an alb, is ripped off by a transectite named Mausmacher, who likes to dress up in Roman regalia. Not content with his own mirror making for crosses, thinks it will be a really bizarre kick to go out to the Zeppelin field to a Nazi torchlight rally in full at random. Green torches flaring, red swastikas, twinkling brasses and fathering out tits and asses, waistlines and baskets, humming a clerical little tune, some Bach riff, smiling as he moves through the Sieg Heil of Die Fahne Hoch. Unknown to him, buys out of the stolen vest mound. He passed by several hundred thousand boots and shoes, and not one so much as brushes him, Natch. He is scavenged next day, a field death empty, columned, pale, streaked with long mud puddles, morning clouds lengthening behind the gilded swastika and wreath, by a poor Jewish rag picker, and taken on into another 15 years of preservation against chance and against Phoebus. He will be screwed into mother, as the female threads of German light bulb sockets are, for some reason that escapes everybody. The cartel have already gone over to contingency plan B, which assumes a 7-year statute of limitations, after which Byron will be considered legally burned out. Meanwhile, all taken off of Byron's case are busy tracking a long-lived bulb that once occupied a socket on the porch of an army outpost in the Amazon jungle. Beatrice the Bulb, who has just been stolen mysteriously by an Indian raiding party. Through his years of survival, all these various rescues of Byron happen as if by accident. Whenever he can, he tries to instruct any bulbs nearby in the evil nature of Phoebus and in the need of solidarity against the cartel. He has come to see how Bulb must move beyond its role as conveyor of light energy alone. Phoebus has restricted Bulb to this one identity. But there are other frequencies above and below the visible band. Bulb can give heat. Bulb can provide energy for plants to grow, illegal plants, inside closets, for example. Bulb can penetrate the sleeping eye and operate among the dreams of men. Some bulbs listened attentively. Others thought of ways to think to Phoebus. Some of the older anti-Byronists were able to fool with their parameters in systematic ways that would show up on the ebonite meters under the Swiss mountain. There were even a few self-immolations, hoping to draw the hitmen down. Any talk of Bulb's transcendence, of course, was clear subversion. Phoebus based everything on Bulb efficiency, the ratio of the usable power coming out to the power put in. The grid demanded that this ratio stay as small as possible. That way, they got to sell more juice. On the other hand, low efficiency meant longer burning hours, and that cut into bulb sales for Phoebus. In the beginning, Phoebus tried increasing filament resistance, reducing the hours of life on the sly, and gradually, till the grid noticed a fall-off in revenues and started screaming. The two parties by and by reached an accord on a compromise bulb life figure that would bring in enough money for both of them and to go 50-50 on the costs of the anti-bulb snatching campaign. Along with a more subtle attack against those criminal souls who forswear bulbs entirely and use candles, Phoebus's long-standing arrangement with the meat cartel was to restrict the amount of tallow in circulation by keeping more fat in meat to be sold regardless of cardiac problems that might arise and redirecting most of what was trimmed off into soap production. Soap in those days was a booming concern. Among the consumers, the Bland Institute had discovered deep feelings about shit. Even at that, meat and soap were minor interlocks of Phoebus. More important were items like tungsten. Another reason why Phoebus couldn't cut down bulb life too far, too many tungsten filaments would eat into available stockpiles of the metal. China being the major world source, this also brought in very delicate policy and disturbed the arrangement between General Electric and Krupp about how much tungsten carbide would be produced, where and when, and what the prices would be. The guidelines settled on were $37 to $90 a pound in Germany, $200 to $400 a pound in the U.S. This directly governed the production of machine tools and thus all areas of light and heavy industry. When the war came, Some people thought it unpatriotic of GE to have given Germany an edge like that, but nobody with any power. Don't worry. Byron, as he burns on, sees more and more of this pattern. He learns how to make contact with other kinds of electric appliances in homes, in factories, and out in the streets. Each has something to tell him. The pattern gathers in his soul, Zele, as the core of the earlier carbon filament was known in. And the grander and clearer it grows, the more desperate Byron gets. Someday he will know everything and still be as impotent as before. His youthful dreams of organizing all the bulbs in the world seem impossible now. The grid is wider, all messages can be overheard, and there are more than enough traitors out on the line. Prophets traditionally don't last long. They are either killed outright or given an accident serious enough to make them stop and think, and most often they do pull back. But on Byron has been visited an even better fate. He is condemned to go on forever, knowing the truth and powerless to change anything. No longer will he seek to get off the wheel. His anger and frustration will grow without limit, and he will find himself, poor, perverse bulb, enjoying it. Laszlo Jampf walks away down the canal where dogs are swimming now, dogs in packs, dogs' heads bobbing down the scummy canals. Dogs also may be found invisible in the air over secret air bases. In the thickest fogs, conditions of temperature, pressure, and humidity form Springer shapes the tuned flyer can feel, the radars can see, the helpless passengers can almost glimpse, now and then, out the little through sheets of vapor. It is the kind dog, the dog no man ever conditioned, who is there for us at beginnings and ends, and journeys we have to take, helpless but not quite unwilling. The pleats in Jampf's suit go weaving away like iris yard wind. The colonel is left alone in Happyville. The steel city waits him, the even cloud light raising a white streak down each great building, all of them set up as modulations on the perfect grid of the streets, each tower cut off at a different height. And where is the comb that will move through this and restore the old perfect Cartesian harmony? Where are the great shears from the sky that will readjust Ville? Need to bring in blood or violence here, but the colonel does have his head tilted back now in what may truly be. His throat is open to the pain radiance of the bulb. Paddy McGonagall is the only other witness, and he, a one-man power system with dreams of his own, wants the colonel out of the way as much as anyone. Eddie Pensiero, with the blues flooding his shaking muscles, the down, mortal blues, is holding his scissors in a way barbers aren't supposed to. The points, shuddering in the electric cone, are aiming downward. Eddie Pensiero's fist tightens around the fingers have slid out of. The colonel exposes his jugular with a... She comes down on a white kerchief at her crown, flutter points, a distinguished emissary from a drained and captured land, herself full of ancient title, but nothing in the way of usable power, not even a fantasy of it. She's wearing a lean white dress, a tennis, falling now not in knife-edge pleats, but softer, more accidental, half-crisp, touches of blue in its deeper folds, a dress for changes in the weather, a dress to be flowed upon by shadows of leaves, by a crumble of brown and sun-yellow moving across it and on as she coasts, preoccupied but without private smiles, under the leafy trees that line the road of hard-packed dirt. In braids up on her head, which she holds not too high, nor what used to be called gravely, say against a particular future, for the first time since the casino Hermann Göring, and she's not of our moment, our time, at all. The outermost sentry peers from his rusty-boned cement roof, and for two full pedal swings they are both, he, Katya, out in the daylight, blending with packed earth, rust, blobbing perforations of sunlight. Cold gold and slick as glass, the fresh wind in the trees. Freudal African eyes, their irises besieged as early cornflowers by the crowding fields of white. Ooga booga, and jump on this tell the rest of the tribe back in the village, yowza. So dum 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 dum. Okay, but still there's no room in her demeanor for even curiosity. Of course, weren't there going to be drums, a chance for violence? A snake jumping off of a limb, a very large presence ahead among the thousand bowing treetops, a scream inside herself, a leap upward into primal terror, surrendering to it, and so, she has dreamt, regaining her soul, her long-lost self. Nor will she waste more than token glances now on the German lawns rushing so deeply away into green hazes or hills, the pale limbs of marble balusters beside sanitarium walks that curve restlessly in a fever, a stifling into thickets of penis-budded sprig and thorn so old, so without comfort that eyes are drawn, seized by the tear glands and dragged to find at all cost the path that has disappeared so suddenly. Or to look behind to hold on to some trace of the spa, a corner of the Sprudelhof, the highest peak of the white sugar bandstand, something to counteract Pan's whisper inside the dark grove, come in, forget them, come in here. No, not Katya. She has moved in thickets. She has danced naked and spread her cunt to the horns of grove-dwelling beasts. She has left the moon in the soles of her feet, taken its tides with the surfaces of her brain. Anne was a lousy lover. Today, in public, they have no more than nervous glances for each other. What does happen now, and this is quite alarming, is that out of nowhere suddenly appear a full dancing chorus of Herero men. They are dressed in white sailor suits, designed to show off asses, crotches, slim waists, and shapely pectorals, and they are carrying a girl all in silver lamé, a loud, brassy dame after the style of Diamond Lil or Texas Guinan. As they set her down, everyone begins to dance and sing, Paranoia, paranoia, ain't it grand to see that good time face again? Paranoia, boy, oh boy, you're just a bit of you-know-what from way back when. Even Goya couldn't draw ya, not the way you looked just kicking in that door. Call a lawyer, paranoia, let me will my ass to you forevermore. Then Andreas and Pavel come out in tap shoes, liberated from a rather insolent Ensa show that came through in July, to do one of those staccato tap and sing numbers. Paranoi, clippity 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 clia up. Paranoi, shuffle stomp, shuffle stomp, shuffle stomp, and clia up. Clickety cl ain't ick it grand clop to clop, see clippy clop your good time face again, etc. Well, Katya realizes long before the first eight bars of all this that the brazen blonde bombshell is none other than herself. She is doing a dance routine with these black sailors ashore. Having gathered also that she is the allegorical figure of paranoia, a grand old dame, a little wacky but pure heart, she must say that she finds the jazzy vulgarity of this music a bit distressing. What she had in mind was more of an Isadora Duncan routine, classical and full of gauzes and, well, white. What pirated her on was folklore, politics, zonal strategies, but not blackness, when that was what she most needed to know about. How can she pass now through so much blackness to redeem herself? How can she expect to find Slothrop among such blackness, sub-vocalizing the word as an old man might speak the name of a base public figure, letting it gutter out into real blackness, into being spoken no more? There is that stubborn, repressive heat to her thoughts. It is none of your heavy, racist skin-prickling, no, but a feeling of one more burden, along with the scarcity of food in the zone, the chicken coop, cave or basement lodgings at sunfall, the armed occupation phobias and skulkings as bad as Holland last year, comfortable in here at least. Lotus snugly, but disastrous out in the world of reality she still believes in and will never give up hoping to rejoin some day. Oh, that's not bad enough. No, now she must also endure blackness. Her ignorance of it must see her through. With Andreas, she is charming. She radiates that sensuality peculiar to women who are concerned with an absent lover's safety. But then she must see Enzian, their first meeting. Each, in a way, has been loved by Captain Blissero. Each had to arrive at some way of making it bearable, for just long enough, one day by one. Oberst, I am happy. Her voice breaks suddenly. Her head inclines across his desk no longer than is necessary to thank, to declare her passivity. The hell she's happy. He nods, angles his beard at a chair. This, then, is the golden bitch of Blissero's last letters from Holland. Ensign formed no image of her then, too taken up, too gagged with sorrow at what was happening to Weissman. She seemed then only one of the expected forms of horror that awaiting his world. But, ethnic when he least wants to be, Ensign came after a while to think of her as the great painting of the white woman, white from the waist down, carrying bow and arrows, trailed by her black handmaiden through an erratic space, figures of all side and fro. But here is the true golden bitch. He's surprised at how young and slender she is. A paleness as of having begun to leak away from this world, likely to vanish any too reckless grasp. She knows her own precarious thinness, her leukemia of soul, and she teases with it. You must want her, but never indicate it, not by eyes or move, or she will clarify, dead gone as smoke above a trail moving into the desert, and you'll never have the chance again. You must have seen him more recently than I. He speaks quietly. She is surprised at his politeness, disappointed. She was expecting more force. Her lip has begun to lift. How did he seem?
Alone.
Her brusque and sideways nod, gazing back at him with the best neutrality she can be sure of in the Cirques. She means you were not with him when he needed you. He was always alone. She understands then that it isn't timidity. She was wrong. It is decency. The man wants to be decent. He leaves himself open. So does she, but only because everything that might hurt has long been numbed out. There's small risk for Katya. But Ensign risks what former lovers risk whenever the beloved is present, in fact, or deepest possibilities for shame, for sense of, or humiliation and mockery. Shall she mock? Has he made that too easy? And then, turning, counted on her for fair play, can she be as honest as he without risking too much?
He was dying, she tells him. He looked very old. I don't even know if he left Holland alive.
He, and this hesitation may be A, in consideration of her feelings, or B, reasons of Schwarzkommando security, or C, both of the above, but the principle of maximizing risk takes over again. He got his Heath. If you didn't know, you ought to.
You've been looking for him.
Yes, so has Slothrop been, though I don't think Slothrop knows that.
Slothrop and I.
She looks around the room, her eyes skitter off metal surfaces, papers, facets of salt, cannot come to rest anywhere. As if making a desperate surprise confession,
everything is so remote now, I don't really know why they sent me out here. I don't know any more who Slothrop really was. There's a failure in the light. I can't see. It's all going away from me.
It isn't yet time to touch her. Reaches out, gives a friendly chin-up tap on the back of her hand. The military, now see here. There are things to hold to. None of it may look real, but some of it is, really.
Really?
They both start laughing. Hers is weary, European, slow, head-shaking. Once she would have been assessing as she laughed, speaking of edges, deeps, profit and loss, H-hours and points of no return, she would have been laughing politically, in response to a power predicament, because there might be nothing else to do. But now she's only laughing, as she once laughed with Slothrop back at the casino Hermann Göring. So she's only been talking with Ensign about a common friend. Is this how the vacuum feels? Slothrop and I didn't work too well. Should she have said, Blissero and I? What would that have got her into with the African? Blissero and I. He begins softly, watching her over burnished cheekbones, cigarette smoldering in his curled right hand. We were only close in certain ways. There were doors I did not open, could not. Around here I play an omniscient. I'd say don't give me away, but it wouldn't matter. Their minds are made up. I am the Berlin Snoot Supreme. Oberhaupt Berliner Schnauze Ensign. I know it all and they don't trust me. They gossip in a general way about me and Blissero as yarns to be spun. The truth wouldn't change either their distrust or my unlimited access. They'd only be passing a story along, another story. But the truth must mean something to you. The Blissero I loved was a very young man, in love with empire, poetry, his own arrogance. Those all must have been important to me once. What I am now grew from that. A former self is a fool, an insufferable ass. But he's still human. You'd no more turn him out than you'd turn out any other kind of cripple, would you?
He seems to be asking her for real advice. Are these the sort of problems that occupy his time? What about the rocket, the empty ones, the perilous infancy of his nation?
What matter to you?
Is what she finally asks. He doesn't have to think for long. He has often imagined the coming of a questioner. At this point, I would take you to a balcony, an observation deck. I would show you the Raketenstadt, plexiglass maps of the webs we maintain across the zone, underground schools, systems for distributing food and medicine. We would gaze down on staff rooms, communications centers, laboratories, clinics. I would say,
all this will I give you if you will, but...
Negative. Wrong story. I would say, this is what I have become. An estranged figure at a certain elevation and distance, who looks out over the Raketenstadt in the amber evenings with washed and darkening cloud sheets behind him, who has lost everything else but this vantage. There is no heart anywhere now, no human heart left in which I exist. Do you know what that feels like? He is a lion, this man. Ego-mad, but despite everything, Katya likes him.
But if he were still alive?
No way to know. I have letters he wrote after he left your city. He was changing terribly. You ask what he could matter to me. My slender white adventurer, grown 20 years, sick and old. The last heart in which I might have been granted some being was changing toad to prince, prince to fabulous monster. If he is alive, he may have changed by now past our recognition. We could have driven under him in the sky today and never seen. Whatever happened at the end, he has transcended. Even if he's only dead, he's gone beyond his pain, his sin, driven deep into their province, into control, synthesis, and control. Further than, well, he was about to say we, but I seems better after all. I haven't transcended. I've only been elevated. That must be as empty as things get. It's worse than being told you won't have to die by someone you can't be. Yes, he matters to me very much. He is an old self, a dear albatross I cannot let go.
And me?
She gathers that he expects her to sound like a woman of the 1940s, and me indeed, but she can think of no other way offhand to help him, to allow him a moment of comfort. You, poor Katya, your story is... She looks up to see exactly how his face will be mocking her. She is stunned to see tears instead running over his cheeks. You've only been set free. His voice then breaking on the last word, his face brushing forward a moment into a cage of hands, then uncaging again for a try at her own gay waltz-time gallows laugh. Oh, no, is he about to go goofy on her, too? What she needs right now in her life, from some man in her life, is stability, mental health, and strength of character, not this. I told Slothrop he was free, too. I tell anybody who might listen. I will tell them as I tell you, you are free. You are free.
How can my story be sadder than that?
Shameless girl, she isn't humoring, flirting with him now. Any tech, great paper, and spider italics young ladyhood ever taught her to keep from having to move into his blackness. Understand, it isn't his blackness, but her own. An inadmissible darkness she is making believe for the moment is Enzian's, something beyond even the center of Pan's Grove, something not pastoral at all, but of the city, a set of ways in which the natural forces are turned aside, stepped down, rectified, or bled to ground and come out very like the malignant dead. The Klipoth that Weismann had transcended, souls whose journey across was so bad that they lost all their kindness back in the blue lightning, the long sea furrows of it rippling, and turned to imbecile killers and jokers, making unintelligible honks in the emptiness, sinewed and stripped thin as rats. A city darkness that is her own, a textured darkness in which flows go in all directions, and nothing begins and nothing ends. But as time passes, things get louder there. It is shaking itself into her consciousness. Flirt if you want. Zia now just as smooth as that Cary Grant. But expect to be taken seriously. Oh, here's what you came for, folks. Not necessarily. His bitterness
all properly receipted in German archives, which may, however, be destroyed now, runs too deep for her, really. He must have learned 1,000 masks, as the city will continue to mask itself against invasions we often do not see, whose outcomes we never learn, silent and pollutions in the warehouse where the walls are blank, the weeds grow thick. And this, no doubt, this suave older one of them. She gets up in a long, long shrug and begins to stalk gracefully in the room, her old style, a girl about 16 who thinks everyone is staring at her. Her hair falls like a hood. Her arms often touch. Come into this any further than locating Slothrop. He finally gets around to telling her. All you have to do is tag along with us and wait till he shows up again, self with the rest.
Because I feel...
Her voice, perhaps by design, very small,
that the rest is exactly what I ought to be doing. I don't want to get away with some shallow win. I don't just want to, I don't know, pay him back for the octopus or something. Don't I have to know why he's out here, what I did to him for them? How can they be stopped? How long can I get away with easy work, cheap exits? Shouldn't I be going all the way in?
Her masochism, Weisspeg, is reassurance for her. That she can still be hurt, that she is human and can cry at pain. Because often she will forget. I can only try to guess how terrible that must be. So, she raises her ass not in surrender but in despair. Your fears of impotence and... Can it still... Will it fail? But of true submission, of letting go the self and passing into the all, there is nothing. Not with Katya. She is not the victim I would have chosen to end this with. Perhaps before the end there will be another, perhaps dream. I am not here, am I, to devote myself to her. You are meant to survive, yes, probably. No matter how painful you want to make it for yourself, still you're always going to come through. You're free to choose exactly how pleasant each passage will be. Usually it's given as a reward. I won't ask for what, I'm sorry, but you seem really not to know. That's why your story is saddest of all.
Reward?
She's getting mad. It's a life sentence. If you call that a reward, then what are you calling me? You black bastard. Exactly. He has allowed her to speak the truth. A clock chimes in the stone corner. We have someone who was with Lucero in May just before the end. You don't have to come and listen. Yes, Oberst, but I will. He rises, crooks her his official and gentlemanly arm, smiling sideways and feeling like a clown. Her own smiling is upward like mischievous Ophelia, just having glimpsed the country of the mad and itching now to get away from court. Feedback, smile to smile, adjustments, waverings. What it damps out to is we will never know each other. Beaming, strangers, la-la-la, off to listen to the end of a man we both loved and were strangers at the films, condemned to separate rows, aisles, exits, homegoings. Far away in another corridor, a loud drill bit strains, smokes just before snapping. Cafeteria trays and steelware rattle, an innocent and kind sound behind familiar regions of steam, fat at the edge of souring, cigarette smoke, wash water, disinfectant, a cafeteria in the middle of the day. There are things... to hold on to. You will want cause and effect, all right. Thanatos was washed overboard in the same storm that took Slothrop from the Anubis. He was rescued by a Polish undertaker in a rowboat, out in the storm tonight to see if he can get struck by lightning. The undertaker is wearing, in hopes it will draw electricity, a complicated metal suit, something like a deep-sea diver's, and a Wehrmacht helmet, through which he has drilled a couple of hundred holes, bolts, springs, and conductive wands of many shapes, so that he jingles whenever he nods or shakes his head, which is often. He's a digital companion, all right. Everything gets either a yes or a no, and two-toned checkerboards of odd shape and texture indeed bloom in the rainy night around him and Thanatos. Ever since reading about Benjamin Franklin in an American propaganda leaflet, Kite, Thunder and Key, the undertaker has been obsessed with this business of getting hit in the head by a lightning bolt. All over Europe, it came to him one night in a flash, though not the kind he wanted, at this very moment are hundreds of people walking around who have been struck by lightning and survived. What stories they could tell. What the leaflet neglected to mention was that Benjamin Franklin was also a Mason, and given to cosmic forms of practical jokes, of which the United States of America may well have been one. Well, it's a matter of continuity. Most people's lives have ups and downs that are relatively gradual, a sinuous curve with first derivatives at every point. They're the ones who never get struck by lightning, no real idea of cataclysm at all. But the ones who do get hit experience a singular point, a discontinuity in the curve of life. You know what the time rate of change is at a cusp? Infinity. That's what. And right across the point, it's minus infinity. How's that for sudden change, eh? Infinite miles per hour, changing to the same speed in reverse, all in the gnat's ass or red cunt hair at the delta T across the point. That's getting hit by lightning, folks. You're way up there on the needle peak of a mountain, and don't think there aren't lammergeiers cruising there in the lurid red altitudes around, waiting for a chance to snap you off. Oh, yes. They are piloted by bareback dwarves with little plastic masks around their eyes that happen to be shaped just like the infinity symbol. Little men with wicked eyebrows, pointed ears, and bald heads, although some of them are wearing outlandish headgear, not at all the usual Robin Hood green fedoras. No, these are Carmen Miranda hats. For example, bananas, papayas, bunches of grapes, pears, pineapples, mangoes, jeepers, even watermelons. And there are World War I spike-top Wilhelmets and baby bonnets and crosswise Napoleon hats with and without ends on them. Not to mention little red suits and green capes. Well, here they are leaning forward into their cruel bird's ears, whispering like jockeys, out to nab you, Buster, just like that sacrificial ape off of the Empire State Building, except that they won't let you fall. They'll carry you away to the places they are agents of. It will look like the world you left, but it'll be different. Between congruent and identical, there seems to be another class of look-alike that only finds the lightning heads. Another world laid down on the previous one, and to all appearances, no different. Aha! But the lightning struck. No. All right. Even if they may not know that, that's what this undertaker tonight has set out into the storm to find. Is he interested in all those other worlds who send their dwarf reps out on the backs of eagles? Nope. Nor does he want to write a classic of anthropology with the lightning struck grouped into a subculture, even secretly organized. Handshakes with sharp cusp flicks of fingernails, private monthly magazine, which looks perfectly innocent, old Ben Franklin, after inflation, unless your proverb is a stockpile of nickel. Making the real, quote, nickel magnate Mark Hanna's, you have been in politics long enough to know that no man in public owes the public anything. So the real title is Long Enough, which those who know, know. The text of each issue of the magazine, when transformed this way, yields many interesting messages. To outsiders, it's just a pleasant little club newsletter. Jed Plunkett held a barbecue for the Iowa chapter the last weekend in April. Heard about the amperage contest, Jed. Tough luck. But come next barbecue, you'll be back good as new. Minnie Calkins, chapter 1.793. Mr. Sunday to a screen door salesman from California. Sorry to say he's not eligible for membership, at least not yet. All those screen doors around, we'll sure keep our fingers crossed. Your editor has been receiving many, many wahoppens concerning the spring convention in Decatur when all the lights failed during the blessing. Glad to report now that the trouble was due to a giant transient in the line. Kind of an electrical tidal wave, Sifner, our engineer on the scene. Every bulb in the place burned out, a ceiling full of sooty, sterile eggs. Quite a poet, Hank. Now, if you can only find out where that spike came from. But does the Polish undertaker in the rowboat care about busting this code about secret organizations or recognizers? No, he doesn't. The reason he is seeking these people out is that he thinks it will help him in his job. Can you dig that, Gates? He wants to know how people behave before and after lightning bolts, so he'll know better how to handle bereaved families. You are perverting a great discovery to the uses of commerce, says Tarnat, stepping ashore. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Minute into the empty town at the edge of the marsh when knuckle, kaun, knuckle, 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 an enormous blast of light and sound hits the water back where the undertaker, peeved at what he takes to be no gratitude, is hauling away. Oh, comes his faint voice. Oh, ho. Oh, ho, ho, ho. Nobody lives here but us. A solid figure, a whispering silhouette, charcoal-colored, has materialized in Thanatos' path. We do not harm visitors, but it would be better if you took another way. They are 170 homosexual prison camp inmates. They have come north from the Dora camp at Nordhausen, north till the land ended and have set up an all-male community between this marsh and the Oder estuary. Ordinarily, this would be Tanatha's notion of paradise, except that none of the men can bear to be out of Dora. Dora was home, and they are homesick. Their liberation was a banishment. So here, in a new location, they have made up a hypothetical SS chain of command. No longer restricted to what destiny allotted then for jailers, they have now managed to come up with some really mean-ass imaginary Nazi playmates. Schutzhäftlingsführer to Blockführer, and chosen an internal hierarchy for themselves too. Lager and Blockältester, Kapo, Vorarbeiter, Stubendienst, Läufer, who is a runner or messenger, but also happens to be the German name for a chess bishop. If you have seen him running across the wet meadows in very early morning with his red vestments furling and fluttering, darkened almost to tree bark color among the watery downs, you will have some notion of his real purpose here inside the community. He is carrier of holy strategies, memoranda of conscience, and when he approaches over the reedy flats of morning, you are taken by your bowed nape and brushed with the sidebands of a great moment. For the Läufer is the most sacred here. It is he who takes messages out to the ruinous interface between the visible Lager and the invisible SS. At the top of the complex is Schutzhäftlingsführer Blissero. The name has found its way this far east, as if carrying on the man's retreat for him, past the last stand in the Lüneburg Heath. He is the zone's worst specter. He is malignant. He pervades the lengthening summer nights. Like a cankered root, he is changing, growing toward winter, growing whiter toward the idleness and the famine. Who else could the 175s have chosen for their very highest oppressor? His power is absolute. And don't think he isn't really waiting, out by the shelled and rusty gasworks, under the winding staircases, behind the tanks and towers, waiting for the dawn's first carmine-skirted runner with news of how the night went. The night is his dearest interest, so he must be told. This phantom SS command here is based not so much on the one the prisoners knew at Dora as on what they inferred to be the rocket structure next door at the Mittelwerke. The A4, in its way, was also concealed behind an uncrossable wall that separated real pain and terror from summoned deliverer. Weissmann / Blissero's presence crossed the wall, warping, shivering into the fetid bunk, the same reach toward another shape as words trying to make their way through dreams. What the 175s heard from their real SS guards there was enough to elevate Weissmann on the spot. They, his own brother elite, didn't know what this man was up to. When prisoners came in earshot, the guards stopped whispering. But their fear kept echoing. Fear not of Weissmann personally, but itself, a time so desperate that he could now move through the Mittelwerke as if he owned it, a time which was granting him a power different from that of Auschwitz or Buchenwald, a power they couldn't have borne themselves. On hearing the name of Blissero now, Tanatz's asshole tightens a notch. Not that he thinks the name was planted here or anything. Paranoia is not a major problem for Tanatz. What does bother him is being reminded at all. Reminded that he's had no word since the noon on the heath when 00000 was fired of Glycero's status, alive or dead, power lord or fugitive. He isn't sure which he prefers. As long as the Anubis kept moving, there was no need to choose. The memory would have been left so far behind that one day its reality wouldn't matter anymore. Of course it happened. Of course it didn't happen. "We think he's out there," the town spokesman is telling Tanatz, "alive and on the run. Now and then we hear something. It could fit Blissero easily enough, so we wait. He will find us. He has a prefabricated power base here waiting for him." "What if he doesn't stay?" "Pure meanness. What if he laughs at you and passes by?" "Then I can't explain," the other beginning to step backward, back out into the rain. "It's a matter of faith." Tanatsu has sworn that he will never seek out Blissero again, not after the 00000, feels the flat of terror's blade. "Who is your runner?" he cries. "Go yourself," a filtered whisper. "Where?" "The gas works. But I have a message for—" "Take it yourself." The white Anubis, gone on to salvation. Back here, in her wake, are the preterite, swimming and drowning, mired and afoot, Poor passengers at sundown who've lost the way, blundering across one another's flotsam, the scrapings, the dreary junking of memories, all they have to hold to, churning, mixing, rising, falling. Men overboard and our common debris. Thanat remains shaking and furious in the well-established rain under the sandstone arcade. I should have sailed on, he wants to scream, and presently does. I wasn't supposed to be left with you discards. Where's the court of appeals that will hear his sad story? I lost my footing. Some mess cook slipped in a puddle of elite vomit and spilled a whole galvanized canful of creamed yellow chicken nausea all over that starboard weather deck. Thanat didn't see it. He was looking for Margarita. Les jeux sont faits. Nobody's listening, and the Anubis is gone. Better here with the swimming debris, Thanat. No telling what'll come sunfishing by. Ask that Oberst Enzian. He knows. There is a key among the wastes of the world, and it won't be found on board the white Anubis because they throw everything of value over the side. So, Thanat is out by the gasworks, up against a tar wall, mackerel eyes bulging out of wet, cool collar shadows, all black and white, really scared, breath smoking out corners of his mouth as green dawn begins to grow back among the gossan. He won't be here. He's only dead. Only dead? Isn't this an interface here, a meeting surface for two worlds? Sure, but which two? There's no counting on any positivism to save him. That didn't even work back in Berlin before the war, at Peter Sachs's sittings. It only got in the way, made others impatient with him. A screen of words between himself and the numinous was always just a tactic. It never let him feel any freer. These days, there's even less point to it. He knows Blissero exists. It wasn't a dream. Don't you wish it could be? Another fever that sooner or later will break, releasing you into the cool reality of a room. You don't have to perform that long and complicated mission after all. No, you see, it was only the... It wasn't real. This time it is real, Glycero. Alive or dead is real. Thanat's a little crazy now with fear, wants to go provoke him. He can't wait anymore. He has to see what it will take to get Glycero across the interface. What screaming, ass-wiggling surrender might bring him back. All it brings is the Russian police. There's a working agreement amidst of the 175 Stadt that, of course, no one told Thanat about. The gasworks used to be a notorious hustling spot till the Russians made a series of mass busts. The echo of the 175 Stadt chorale goes skipping away down the road, singing some horrible salute to faggotry, such as, Yumsy numsy and poopsy poo, if I'm a degenerate, so are you. Nowadays, all we get are you tourists, says the natty civilian with the white handkerchief in his breast pocket, snickering in the shadow of his hat brim. And, of course, the odd spy. Not me, Thanat says. Not you, eh? Tell me about it. Something of a quandary, all right. In less than half a day, Thanat has moved from no need to worry or even think about Blissero to always needing some formulation of him at hand to please any stray curious cop. This is one of his earlier lessons in being preterite. He won't escape any of the consequences he sets up for himself now, not unless it's by accident. For example, at the outskirts of Stettin, by accident, a Polish guerrilla group just arrived back from London mistakes the police car for one transporting an anti-Lublin journalist to prison, shoots out the tires, roars in, kills the driver, wounds the civilian interrogator, and escapes lugging Thanat like a sack of potatoes. Not me, Thanat says. Shit, he's right. They roll him out of the car door into a DP encampment a few miles farther on. He is herded into a wire enclosure along with 1,999 others being sent west to Berlin. For weeks he rides the freights, hanging in shifts to the outside of his assigned car while inside someone else sleeps on the straw space he vacated. Later they change places. It helps to stay awake. Every day Thanat sees half a dozen DPs go on the nod and fall off the train, and sometimes it's funny to watch not. Though DP humor is a very dependent thing. He is rubber-stamped on hands, forehead, and ass, deloused, poked, palpated, named, numbered, consigned, invoiced, misrouted, detained, ignored. He passes in and out the paper grasp of Russian, British, American, and French body jobbers, round and round the occupation circuit, getting to recognize faces, coughs, pairs of boots on new owners. Without a ration card or Zoldbuch, you are doomed to be moved in lots of to center about the zone, possibly forever. So, out among the ponds and fence posts of Mecklenburg somewhere, Thanat discovers that he is exempt from nothing. His second night on the rails, his shoes are stolen. He comes down with a deep bronchial cough and a high fever. For a week, no one comes to look at him. For two aspirins, he has to suck off the orderly in charge, who has grown to enjoy rough-bearded cheeks flaming at 103 degrees against his thighs, the furnace breath under his balls. In Mecklenburg, Tanat steals a cigarette butt from a sleeping one-armed veteran and is beaten and kicked for half an hour by people whose language he has never heard before, whose faces he never gets a look at. Bugs crawl over him, only slightly irritated that he's in their way. His daily bread is taken away by another DP smaller than he is, but with the look of some right to it, a look Tanat at best can only impersonate. And he's afraid to go after the little rag-coated, liver-colored back, the munching haystack head. And others are watching. The woman, who tells everyone that Tanat molests her little girl at night. Tanat can never meet her eyes because, yes, he wants to. Pull down the slender, pretty pubescence, oversized GI trousers, stuff penis between pale little buttocks, reminding him so of Bianca, take bites of soft as bread insides of thighs, pull long hair, throat back Bianca, make her moan, move her head, how she loves it. And a beetle-browed Slav, too, who has forced Tanat to go hunting cigarette butts for him after lights out, to give up his sleep not so much to the chance of finding a real butt as to the Slav's right to demand it. The Slav is watching, too. In fact, a circle of enemies have all observed the taking of the bread and Tanat's failure to go after it. Their judgment is clear. A clarity in their eyes Tanat never saw back on the Anubis, an honesty he can't avoid, can't shrug off. Finally, he has to face, literally with his own real face, the transparency, the real light of... Little by little, his memory of that last rocket firing on the heath grows clearer. The fever's fire polish, the pain removes impurities. An image keeps recurring, a muddy brown, almost black eyeball, reflecting a windmill and a jagged reticule of tree branches in silhouette. Doors at the sides of the windmill open and shut quickly like loose shutters in a storm. In the iris sky, one cloud, the shape of a clamshell, rises very purple around the edges, the puff from an explosion, something light ochre at the horizon. Closer in, it seems snarling purple around a yellow that's brightening, intestines of yellow shadowed in violet, spilling outward in a bellying curve toward us. There are, oddly, not to cut this picturesque scene off, but oddly enough, get this, no windmills on the Lüneburg Heath. Tanat even checked around real fast just to make sure. Nope, no windmills. Okay, so how come Blissero's eye looking out on the heath is reflecting a windmill, huh? Well, to be honest, now it isn't reflecting a windmill, it's reflecting a bottle of gin. Gin out here on the heath either, but it was reflecting a windmill. What's this? Could it be that Blissero's eyes, in which Greta Erdmann saw maps of his kingdom, are for Tanat's reflecting the past? That would be strange. Whatever went on those eyeballs, when you weren't looking, would just be lost. You'd only have fragments now and then. Katya looking back over her shoulder at fresh whip marks. Gottfried in the morning lineup, body all over Van der Vogel limp. Wind blowing his uniform in great ripples back from the bow curves of his thighs, hair flying in the wind, saucy sideways smile, mouth a little open, jaw forward, eyelids down. Glycero's own reflection in the oval mirror, an old face, he is about to don a wig. A dragon lady page boy with bangs, and he pauses, looking in, face asking, What did you say? Wig held to the side and slightly lower so as to be another face and heavy wig shadows nearly invisible. But looking closer, you can see bone ridges and fat fields begin to emerge now, an ice glaze white bobbing, a mask handheld over the shadows in the hollow hood space. Two faces looking back now. And Tanat, are you going to judge this man? Tanat, haven't you loved the whip? Haven't you longed for the brush and sigh of ladies' clothes? Haven't you wanted to murder a child you loved, joyfully kill something so helpless and innocent? As he looks up at you, at the last possible minute, trusting you, and smiles, purses his lips to make a kiss, just as the blow falls across his skull. Isn't that best of all? The cry that breaks in your chest then. The sudden, solid arrival of loss. Loss forever. The irreversible end of love, of hope. No denying what you finally are. But so much fear at taking it in. The serpent face, opening your arms and legs and letting it enter you. Into your true face, it'll kill you. He is telling the Schwarzkommando this now, all this and more. After a week of shouting, I know, of crying, "I've seen the Schwarzgerät." Whenever a black face appears behind the flowing wire fences, at the cinder banks or the crossings, word has got around. One day they come for him. He is lifted from the straw as black with coal dust as they, as an infant, a roach flicked in kindness off of his face, and transported shivered, tethered, moaning south to the Erdschweinhöhle, where now they are all sitting around a fire, smoking and munching, eyes riveted on Blue Donuts, who has been gabbing for 7 hours nonstop. He is the only one privileged, in a way, to tell this much of the story. He's the fella who lost out, the loser. Just a fool who never wins at love, though he plays most every night. A loser to the ones above, who stack the cards of wrong and right. Oh, the loser never bets at all, and he never plays to win. He knows if once you don't succeed, you can always lose again. Just a loser at the game of betting night after night alone. He lost Gottfried, he lost Bianca, and he is only beginning this late into it to see that they are the same loss to the same winner. By now he's forgotten the sequence in time, doesn't know which child he lost first, or even hornet clouds of memory welling up, even if they aren't two names, the same child. But then in the crash of others' flotsam, sharp edges and high spin velocity, understand he finds he can't hold on to this thought for long. Soon he's floundering in the open water again. But he'll remember a little, saw its texture and color, felt it against the side of his face as he woke from a space of sleeping near it, that the two children, Gottfried and Bianca, are the same. It wasn't quite as real. After the last firing, the unremembered night hours to Hamburg, the hop from Hamburg to Bydgoszcz in a purloined P-51 Mustang, was so clearly Prokhorovsky down out of the sky in a machine that Tanats came to imagine he had disposed of Blissero II only in that same very conditional metallic way. And sure enough, the metal has given way to flesh and sweat and long chattering night encounters, Blissero cross-legged stammering down at his crotch, "I can't, Blissero, couldn't, care, cry." Blissero that night was offering all his weapons, laying down all maps of his revetments and labyrinths. Donuts was really asking, when mortal faces go by, sure, self-consistent and never seeing me, are they real? Are they souls, really, or only attractive sculpture, the sunlit faces of clouds? And how can I love them? But there's no answer from Blissero. His eyes go casting runes with the windmill silhouettes. A number of contributed scenes do now flash by for Tanats, from Ensign Morituri, a banana leaf floor somewhere near Malabakat in the Philippines, late 44, a baby squirms, rolls, kicks in drops of sunlight, raising dust off the drying leaves, and the special attack units roar away overhead, zeros bearing comrades away finally as fallen cherry blossoms, that favorite kamikaze image in the spring. From Greta Erdmann, a world below the surface of earth or mud, it crawls like mud but cries like earth, with layer-pressed generations of gravities and losses thereto. Losses, failures, last moments followed by voids stringing back, a series of caves caught in the suffocated layers, those forever lost. From someone who'll ever know who. A flash of Bianca in a thin cotton shift, one arm back, the smooth, powdery hollow under the arm, and a leaping bow of one small breast, her lowered face all but forehead and cheekbone in shadow turning this way, the lashes now whose lifting you pray for. Will she see you? A suspension forever at the hinge of doubt, to it doubting of her love. They'll help him through it. The Erdschweinhörlers will sit up all night with this non-stop intelligence briefing. He is the angel they've hoped for. And it's logical he should come now on the day when they have their rocket all assembled at last, their single A-4 scavenged all summer, piece by piece, clear across the zone from Poland to the Low Countries. Whether you believed or not, empty or green, cunt crazy or politically celibate, power playing or neutral, you had a feeling, a suspicion, a latent wish, some hidden tithe out of your soul, something for the rocket. It is that something that the angel Tanats now illuminates, each in a different way, for everybody listening. By the time he's done, they will all know what the Schwarzgerät was, how it was used, where the 00000 was fired from, and which way it was pointed. Entheon will smile grimly and groan to his feet, the decision already made for him hours ago, and say, "Well, Let's have a look at the timetables now. Erich Feinherr, arrival empty one. Yosef Umbindi grips him by the forearm. If there's anything, Enzian nods. See if you can work us out a tight security watch. Gorandi. He hasn't called Umbindi that for a while. Nor is it a small concession to give the empty ones control of the watch lists, at least for the duration of this journey. Which has already begun. As 1.5 levels below, men and women are busy with tackle, lines, and harness, easing rocket sections each onto its dolly, more Schwarzkommando waiting in leather and blue-flowered files up the ramps to the outside, along the present and future vectors strung between wood rails and grooves, empty, neutral, and green all together now, waiting or hauling or supervising, some talking for the first time since the dividing along lines of racial life and racial death began. How many years ago, reconciled for now in the only event that could have brought them together? I couldn't, Enzian knows, and shudders at what's going to happen after it's over. But maybe it's only meant to last its fraction of a day. And why can't that be enough? Try to let it be enough. Christian comes past, downhill adjusting a web belt, not quite swaggering. Night before last, his sister Maria visited him in a dream to tell him she wished no revenge against anyone and wanted him to trust and love the Ingwaroreru. So their eyes now meet, not quite amused, nor quite yet in a challenge, but knowing more together than they ever have so far. And Christian's hand, at the moment of passing, cocks out half in salute, half in celebration, aimed toward the heath, northwesterly, kingdom of deathward. And Enzian's goes out the same way. Ia, Goranje, as at some point the two palms do slide and brush, do touch. And it is touch and trust enough for this moment. Unexpectedly, this country is pleasant, yes, once inside it, quite pleasant after all. Even though there is a villain here, serious as death, it is this typical American teenager's own father trying episode after episode to kill his son. And the kid knows it. Imagine that. So far, he's managed to escape his father's daily little death plots. But nobody has said he has to keep escaping. End of side 21. To continue, turn the cassette over.